You're listening to the Darabin Fuse Festival. This five-part podcast series is a collaboration with the First Time Podcast and is part of Darabin's Spring Festival program. Conversations were recorded on the land of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people, and we'd like to acknowledge them as the traditional owners and custodians of the land and pay respects to their elders past, present and future. Episodes in this Fuse series will be released fortnightly and feature local creatives Kate McLennan, Leanne Hall, Eve Reese, Clementine Ford, and McKinley Valentine. Happy listening. Kate McLennan is an award-winning writer, stand-up comedian, and actress. She's the co-writer of The Catering Show, where she plays an intolerable foodie alongside her food-intolerant mate, Kate McCartney. The show launched on YouTube in 2015 and hit over 2 million views in its first week online. In 2017, having conquered the world of satirical cooking shows, the Kate set their sights on the chirpy world of morning TV, with their signature brand of social awkwardness and unprofessionalism in their full-length series entitled Get Cracking, which aired on the ABC the same year. The second and final season aired to much critical acclaim on the ABC in 2019. Kate has appeared in 13 Melbourne International Comedy Festivals and performed stand-up comedy throughout Australia, the UK, the US, Hong Kong and Singapore. Kate also toured India with MICF when she hosted the Roadshow and Raw Comedy competitions. Kate, we interview a lot of writers on this show. One way that you are pretty different to a lot of them is that you have a pretty long-time creative partner in Kate McCartney. You've worked together on The Catering Show, Get Cracking, your podcast. How did that partnership come about?
It started off kind of as a friendship that formed with, like, the two of us sort of being mutual admirers of one another on Twitter. Probably more me, so an admirer of her than the other way around. But it was around sort of 2010, 2011. And, it was kind of that, you know, great time on Twitter, I suppose, when people would just write jokes on Twitter. You know, that's what kind of what Twitter was about. And so I'd known of her for years because we – obviously, we have a very similar name and we're both kind of acting around the same time as each other when we were in our early 20s. And we had mutual friends, but also there was a time there for a while where I'd get cast in a sketch comedy show and then she'd get cast in a sketch comedy show, but we were never ever cast in the same sketch comedy show. So it was like we had these forces kind of keeping us apart. And so then we kind of started following each other on Twitter and just kind of got together one day and had a bottle of wine and just talked about, like, everything terrible that had happened to us. We just kind of bonded over just these war stories. And I think also we were both at a point in our careers as well where we were really, really jack of TV, and we'd worked in, you know, different writers' rooms and we'd been trying to get our own stuff up and kind of had never really, I don't think we'd ever felt like we were in a situation where people were kind of listening or really getting us, I suppose. And so we just, yeah, and we'd both had some pretty crappy experiences being involved in TV shows as well. So, yeah, I think we were kind of a bit disillusioned with TV. And then we met each other and kind of just went, okay, well, what if we sort of developed something that was, you know, an online show, like a web series? And so we started working on this show called Bleak, which was a it started off as a web series, and we applied for a what was it? It was a thing that the Australian Writers Guild were doing, like it was called the Kit Denton Disfellowship. It's like a writer's grant, essentially. And so we started getting together to write this pitch for that competition, and we just sort of clicked. Like, there was just, like, our writing really, there was just an energy to it, and the ideas that we had, we really made each other laugh. And we really liked what we were writing. We thought it was funny and it kind of spoke to our experience at that time. And yeah, and then it won that award, which was a big moment for us. It was a very validating thing to happen because it was, I mean, for the first time, it felt like we'd sort of been recognised, I suppose, or that, you know, there was just a little nod sort of going, yeah, you're doing a good job. And so we just kept going from there. Like it just sort of, and we had, you know, we're very, very dear friends as well. And that's kind of, yeah, like that sort of, we're very loving and respectful to each other. And so because our friendship's been so important, it's also meant that our writing and our working collaboration is something that we really nurture and look after. And, you know, so it's, you know, I think that's why we've kind of, we sort of don't really have any intention of not working with each other for the rest of our lives, you know. Like I know that we'll do different things, but I think that we always, yeah, we see each other as a team.
One of the things that you've said is that the original idea for the catering show was the fact that McCartney does actually have a lot of food intolerances.
Yeah.
Once you had that concept, what happened next?
Yeah, well, it's a bit sort of the way that it kind of worked. Going back to that other project that we were working on, Bleak, we did a possible campaign to turn that into a web series, and we filmed a video for it that was essentially just pleading with our relatives to give us money. And it was the first time we'd done anything on camera together, and it was a direct camera address kind of little 3-minute video, and people loved it. Like people just thought that video, like people really, they just really connected with it in a way that they probably didn't connect with the actual project that it was running, raising money for. It was like, that was.
Oh, right. The fundraising video was what they connected with. Right.
That was random. And you could see, like you could just tell by this reaction that it had online and like people contacting us, and but people really clicked with it. And so we knew then, we're like, okay, there's something in this idea of the two of us performing together on camera. And so we had it sort of just in the back of our mind that we're looking for something to do together. And so when McCartney got diagnosed with having I don't even know what it's called, but she has to follow like this FODMAP diet. So there's lots of food restrictions involved with that. And then I kind of had just started going out with my partner Joel at that time, and he loves food and was, you know, it was kind of like that height of MasterChef. And, you know, we'd moved from Fitzroy out to Thornbury, and we were very much in this kind of like locking down our domestic kind of like, you know, we were complete stereotype, you know, northern suburb foodie stereotype.
It feels very familiar.
And so then, you know, with McCartney, it was like, you know, come around for dinner. Come around for a dinner party. And she's like, I can't eat anything. I'm like, I'll find something. I'll make her something. And then I'd try to make her food. I'm like, you're a nightmare. And like when we go out for dinner and stuff, like with our friends, I'd be like, you just come and meet us later for drinks. Like it's just... And it was just this kind of, conflict between the two of us that was funny and entertaining. And we could kind of take the piss out of ourselves and our relationship while doing it. And so that's kind of, we sort of saw that there was some, you know, there was a frisson there. So we, so that's kind of where the idea clicked into place. And we thought, okay, there's enough, there's enough conflict there and enough humour, and we're taking the piss, and, you know, it's, we thought there was enough in it. And so we applied for this thing called Fresh Blood with the ABC. And so, you know, you pitch a show to, I think it was like you got 10 grand to film something, and they said no. So we were like, oh, no, it's a bad idea, shit. And then around the same time, we applied for a Screen Australia funding to develop it into a web series, and that was $150,000. And we were like, we're not going to get this, but we worked really, really hard on the application, and it was a very involved application. Like we were doing marketing plans and budgets and, you know, looking at analytics and marketing, you know, online marketing strategies, and we were really, and then we had to do like episode synopses, and we just
have to learn that stuff around marketing.
We had no idea about it, so yeah, we just kind of we sort of learnt on the ground with it. But, I mean, we had released that other web series beforehand, so we sort of knew a little bit about, like, we'd had a little bit of success with that. We'd won a lot of web series, like comedy, or, like, been, you know, shortlisted and stuff, so for awards and stuff with that little web series. So we kind of knew that, like, how to pluck different things to kind of make it look like we knew what we were doing. I mean, also, I think we showed that we could actually get something up and, you know, and make it. We could take it from an idea to it being a finished product. And so we applied for the Screen Australia funding and we got it. And that was, yeah, again, that was another one of those game-changing kind of moments. That first series was made with them.
Did you have a goal for that first series? Is there something you wanted to get out of it?
We wanted to get 10,000 views because the last wow. web series prior to that, I think we maybe had gotten overall maybe 5,000 or 6,000 views or something. So we're like, if we could get 10,000 views,
oh, wow.
we'd be with that. And then it went nuts. So, I mean, you know, nuts for us. There's a lot of YouTube stuff.
2 million views, like incredible in like a really short space of time too.
Yeah. People really grabbed hold of that, the Thermomix episode, and they ran like different sort of websites and media kind of publications ran articles on it and share the video, and so it kind of took off, which was great. You know, it was, yeah, changed everything.
And what does the writing process actually look like? You mentioned you did a synopsis for that first series. Is that how you guys work?
Yeah, so at the moment we're working on two things at the moment, and we had very different kind of processes with both of those show. So one of them was an audio series and then one of them is a TV series that we've been doing development for, whereas the audio series, there sort of wasn't a budget to do extensive development. That one's set in Antarctica. And so we did lots of research for that and interviews and, you know, lots of reading and listening to podcasts about Antarctica because we couldn't go. So I was like, okay, we're trying to arm ourselves with as much information. And we knew we sort of had this central character. And so we didn't do any development. We didn't write any character bios. We wrote episode outlines that were very loose in that we're like, okay, this episode's going to be about Christmas, or this episode's going to be about, you know, all the female expeditioners going out on a trip with each other. And so we had kind of these loose kind of ideas for episodes that completely change as you write it. But so we write these outlines and then we get feedback on the outlines and then we do a 3-draft process. And so we had a script editor working with us on the first and second drafts, first and second drafts. And so that's been, that's been really great. So that was 8 half-hour episodes that we've written for that. And that's kind of all written. We're just waiting to record it because we can't get people in a room at the moment to do it.
And will that be you guys performing the main roles in that?
No, we've got two of the smaller roles in this one just because we feel like there's other people who can do a much better job of it than we can. We've got two little silly kind of ongoing roles in it, but the cast is, we're still casting it at the moment, but it should be lots of fun. I guess the way that we're kind of moving now is less us being on camera or being cast, because we show run as well. It's a really massive job, and McCartney directs, and you know, we both write nearly, you know, a lot of what we do. And so we've sort of found with the last season of Get Cracking, like it almost felt like being on the show was getting in the way of us being able to do our jobs, which is weird. Like the day that I had that realization, I was like, okay, I don't think I identify as an actor anymore, because I've always sort of been a performer. And I was like, it's stopping me from being able to do my job. I need to not, you know, prioritize that. I'd much rather kind of write and sort of be kind of involved in the creative process behind camera now. So, yeah, but that's, you know, that's a whole other thing. But, yeah, but with the other TV series that we're in development for, that's been a much more traditional sort of TV process where we did – how did we start? We've actually been developing this. So between the two of us, we started working on it probably about 4 or 5 years ago. And then we got we pitched it in the States last year. And so we've got some development backing for that. And so we have been doing workshops with other writers. So we sort of did a week of workshops with them. And then from there, we had to develop a Bible, which I don't know, should I describe what a Bible is?
Yeah, that'd be great.
So in TV, quite often what you'll do is develop the Bible first, which is, you know, essentially it's a manual for the show. You know, it's it sets up the world, the characters, and then also has some reflections on sort of you as the creators as to what your intention is behind the show, what the tone and the look and the feel. It's sort of, you know, it's a working document that kind of lays everything out that may not necessarily be evident just from the pilot. So I guess it's, you know, this is what you might, you know, expect from the whole series. This is the journey these characters are going to go on. So it's kind of, yeah, it's a roadmap, I suppose. And so we, you know, and they can be long or they can be short. We wrote one and I think it was 97 pages, which is too long for anyone listening. It's too long. But we found that we just had to, because it's an hour long, 1 hour episodes, we just found that we had to have all the answers, you know, or at least know that we could find the answers. So it was quite a detailed, involved document. And it will evolve. The information in there will keep changing as we develop the show. But, you know, it's a leaping off point, I suppose. So
is it very different working with – it sounds like you're working with a team of writers, whereas it's historically been the two of you. Is that why a document like that becomes so –
Yeah, well, the workshop was with writers, but then we paired it back to just the two of us again. And then, so we did that process. So it was kind of like using a lot of information that we, you know, had come up with in the workshops and character information and, you know, little plot ideas here and there. But then sort of McCartney and I kind of fleshing it all out. So, yeah, so we do bring it back to the two of us, and then from there I guess it'll be something that should the show get up, then when we bring writers in to write different episodes for it, which we'll do this time because it's just like if we wrote every episode we'd be writing for 3 years. So, yeah, so there's guest writers. So, you know, it's something that we can hand them and go, okay, this is the template. This is sort of what, that Bible kind of sets you up. Yeah, so we did that, and then that included episode outlines as well for all of them. And, and then we sort of got the tick to move to the next stage, and so then we wrote a pilot outline. So then that's just sort of a bit more fleshed out, like a treatment, kind of describing everything that happens on screen. And we kind of write it like a scene-by-scene kind of, you know, and that's all in prose. And then we go to draft one, which was a real adjustment from sitting in, you know, writing prose for months and months to then go back to writing a script. And it was just like, and also from going from writing an audio series back to TV again, and just, there's like slight shifts that you've got to, you know, the big print becomes something completely different in an audio series. Like it's literally just sound effects that you can't write any action in an audio series. So then we had to, you know, flip it again with the TV script. And also, you know, it's just when you're writing an audio series, there's a lot of like, hi, Nina, how are you? I'm good. Yeah? Like there's a lot of, you know, like who's in this room? What are you doing in the kitchen? You know, that kind of setting the scene, which we obviously don't need to do. You know, we can be a lot more economical when it's in a visual format.
And when you're at that stage of writing the scene, is it the two of you still in a room together?
Yeah.
Thinking, so this person should say this.
Yeah, and we we improvise a lot of the dialogue in the room, and quite often, like this is the second time we've written an episode one for this particular series, and there's certain scenes that we have had in there from like the very beginning. And there's certain conversations and certain lines of dialogue that we feel like they become sort of like these tone setters for what the show is. So it's like if we can kind of identify what, you know, like a line that might actually be kind of at the heart of how that character talks or that character's worldview. And so they become these little touchstones, I suppose, for a particular scene or indeed the whole episode, the whole series. So, and also they're representative of how McCartney and I, like what our sense of humour is, I suppose. So there's a lot of our work kind of really evolves around these silly scenes that we might make up, you know, improvise, and that, you know, they could have happened years ago. And so we still do that. We do the dialogue back and forth with each other. And it's really like to get the outline sort of written, I'm probably more the draft zero person, whereas McCartney's very, she polishes things, and she's really, she sort of likes to have all the answers before she might start writing something. Whereas, well, actually, that's not true. That's probably not true. I'm probably more, the two of us have realised, I suppose, that sometimes you just got to throw something down onto the page and then, you know, start that process of refining it. And so I'm probably more the person that will just go, right, I'm just gonna write some shit, okay? And, you know, and that's kind of how the name for our podcast, Only Wrong Answers, came about, because we just, you know, one day we were writing and we're like, there's only wrong answers. There's only wrong answers. And kind of once we took the pressure off trying to come up with the right answer, it was like we felt more free to just go, this is going to be the wrong answer. Doesn't matter, but we're going to put it down. And that's kind of how we start, you know, overcoming that first sort of hurdle of, you know, I don't know what to write. I don't know where to start. You know, it's just like, well, we'll just start somewhere and it'll probably be wrong, but, you know, at least we'll know that it's wrong and we can do something different. And so that's kind of, yeah. So, yeah, McCartney and I used to write more that McCartney was on the keyboard and I was sort of just like hanging around the room, just like saying, you know, doing character dialogue and stuff. Cause I guess that's like my background is doing character comedy and stuff. So that's sort of like, I like to sit in the characters and find their voices and their tone. But now now that we can actually write in the same document at the same time with, you know, the invention of Google Docs, and there's a script writing program that we use now where we can both be in there at the same time. And so we kind of, we just both, you know, there's very much a draft zero that gets written, and then just start that refining process from there. So it's, we always write long. We have a terrible time with cutting our work down. We never struggle to fill the time frame that we're supposed to be writing in.
I'm interested in looking at the second season of The Catering Show. Had a really different feel, I think, in a lot of ways to the first season. Very overt politicalness, really, towards the end. Or right the way through, really.
Of which show? Of Catering Show or Get Cracking?
Sorry, of Get Cracking. Sorry, Get Cracking.
Yeah. I was going to say.
Yeah,
I'm trying to remember the difference between one and two of Catering Show.
Sorry, you're right. Get Cracking.
Blurred in my mind. Can I drink? Sorry. There we go.
Go for it. Is that something that you've brought into this more recent work that you're working on as well?
Yes, and something there's like, I think with Get Cracking, there was like a really deliberate. There was a deliberate kind of decision to write about, you know, the world that we were living in and we were looking at how, I mean, I guess with The Catering Show, it was very much about the two of us and kind of our worldview and our experiences. And we were like, we kind of wanted to open it out. And, yeah, and so as the, you know, season one to season two evolved, we kind of developed different ways of being able to do that. So the second season of that was, you know, we worked with other writers on developing specific episodes, which we found to be kind of really effective way of people sort of being able to present their position and their view, but still having ownership and agency within an episode, rather than just kind of handing their material over to us.
The disability episode is a fascinating thing to dissect in that respect. I just think of the Auslan signers,
yeah,
sort of having jokes that such a tiny proportion of an audience can understand, which is such an experiential statement, isn't it?
Yeah, and we had to really push back a couple of times with different people who from like the ABC or whatever saying, you know, can we put subtitles on to let the audience know what they're saying? And we're like, no, because that defeats the whole purpose of it, that, you know, we want to show what it's like to not be prioritised and to miss out on something and how frustrating that can be. And just go, you know, that's kind of the norm for people who are deaf, you know, that they aren't catered to. And so we wanted to have, you know, the hearing audience to experience that. And, you know, and Jess Walton Healy, who developed the episode, we all co-wrote the episode with us, she brought us this idea. And we just thought that, you know, she was just going to pitch us a sketch, and she came in with this fully formed idea for an episode. And we're like, yep, amazing, let's do it. And then we also collaborated with Alistair Baldwin on a couple of sketches as well, who then we just adored him so much when we met him that we wrote him into the show. And we continue to work with Alistair as well. He's a really great writer, a really, really funny writer, very smart. And so, yeah, and then episode 8 with Nakia, that we, you know, we developed it with Miranda and Nakia. And that was kind of something that was a continuation of working with them in season one. And so we just kind of kept a dialogue running with the two of them. And then, you know, it just felt like it was a really perfect way to end the series and to say kind of, I don't know, to use our time wisely. And, it was a really rewarding experience to work so collaboratively. With other writers and other performers, and kind of just hand it over, you know? And yeah, Get Kraken was a really intense time. It's a very, once we kind of made a decision to not just do like a lifestyle show, that, you know, we kind of had the idea to do this morning show format, and then morning shows just started behaving in such an appalling way, and we felt like it would be remiss of us to not incorporate that into the show and to not call out that behaviour, and to ignore that just felt like we were doing our time and our opportunity a disservice.
It's funny because it was so satirical, it almost felt like it felt real at the same time as, like, which is horrifying.
Yeah, and it felt real to make. Like, it was like being involved, you know, having to be that engaged with the news cycle and to be across, like, trends, and then to be across celebrity stuff, like, you know, to have all of that stuff swirling around in our lives for a few years. It was really, it was a very intense time, and we have really needed to have a break from writing sketch comedy, and we kind of just... Yeah, like we'll always write work that's political, and we'll always want to say something. Like, we feel like if you're existing in the world, then you need to, you know, you need to write about how that affects you, you know, that's and how it affects people. And I think it's to kind of write, you know, being oblivious to the world around you. It's sort of not what we're about. So... The audio series that we've written is about, it's set in Antarctica, and it does talk about climate change and sort of addresses sort of a lot of the climate change anxiety that we have, but it is very, it's a lot gentler and lighter than Get Kraken. And it's kind of like, I guess, where we were at mentally was just like we just needed to take the pressure off slightly. And also, you know, it was kind of in response to doing interviews with the people that work down there. And it just, everyone down there just has such, they have such strong values and ethics. And, you know, they're used to working in groups and, you know, living for long periods of time in confined spaces with other people. And everyone's very, just lovely. Like we just, everyone we spoke to was very well intentioned. They had such a passion for Antarctica and for their colleagues and for the research station. And yeah, everyone's very well intentioned. And so we were like, used to writing conflict and having such grit. And we're like, this is not what this place is. And so it's a lot softer. And it, you know, it becomes about interpersonal relationships and also just really, it's very silly. There's a lot more silliness, I think, in this than other shows that we've done, which is probably saying something. But it's just kind of a little break, I suppose. And in a way, like when we got to the end of it, we had to actually write some character bios for the actors who we were approaching, sort of, you know, describing what these characters were like. And so coming back to that process after we'd finished writing it, which is, you know, usually the other way around, we did realise that we kind of were like, we haven't really laid the boot in that much with climate change, but a lot of kind of the characters that we look at, we sort of, it's like the quirks and what we explore with them down there are all kind of their escape mechanisms for how they cope with, you know, being at the front, like facing that full kind of force of climate change. And, you know, so it's sort of what they do to kind of take a break from it as well. So, yeah, it's a lot gentler, but it's, you know, it's still, we still talk about climate change, but just, you know, it's probably not as overt, I suppose, or hard hitting, just because where we were at, we're like, you know, we just need to write something that's sort of a bit happy and just, you know, just a nice listen. The TV project is, I don't even know how to describe it, even though that's what I've been spent the last few months kind of, I don't know how much I can sort of say about it, but it's a comedy, but it's an hour-long comedy that's structured like a crime Nordic noir series, and it functions as a mystery as well. So it does, yeah, it has that detective crime element to it, and there's, you know, in those storylines, and it should operate with that same level of suspense and intrigue, but it's also funny. So it's a bit of a balancing act. So it's very much like stylistically it's very different, and it's I mean, Get Kraken was such an ugly show, and I mean that in a, like, an aesthetic kind of sense that, like, it's, you know, this overlit studio, you know, and we were dressed in these, like, tight, like, we really wanted to sort of highlight the grotesque nature of that TV format. And so we didn't really look for the beauty in the frame, and whereas now we get to write something that is, like, visually stunning, and it, you know, hopefully it's going to be set down in Tasmania, and so, you know, really arresting, beautiful scenery and very moody atmospheric soundtrack, and, you know, like, it's very it's nice to be able to write something that is hopefully really visually arresting and satisfying as well and enjoyable, but it's still very political, like it's still saying something. Yeah, and it, you know, it'll get quite dark at times as well. So it's I think we're always going to have some kind of political commentary going on.
It would be great if we can get some advice from you for other writers and creatives. One of the things we often talk about is rejection or criticism. Mm. I think there's probably no faster form of audience feedback than having worked in stand-up comedy. Any particularly crushing or negative experiences you're happy to share?
It's like, you're right.
Pretty unscathed.
The stand-up stuff is, I mean, that's brutal, you know. It's just brutal, the response of, you know, an audience, a collective group of people deciding that they don't like you. It's really, like, I did a gig when I was probably, how old was I? I was about 28, and I did a spot at the Hi-Fi Bar for Comedy Festival, and it was a Saturday night, which is sort of, you know, notoriously the, you know, this, you know, top billing kind of night. And like Patton Oswalt was on the lineup, and I did a character, except I changed my mind about what character I was going to do seconds before I went out on stage. The MC had asked me, do you want me to introduce you in any particular way? And I said, just as Kate McLennan, that's fine. And then I went out as a character, and I didn't have a costume. I had nothing to indicate that I was a character, because I just thought I could transform myself just, you know, in front of the audience with, you know, a subtle change of posture. And they just, like, there was literally, you could hear a pin drop, and, like, nobody laughed. And, like, you know, some people say, I'm sure people laughing, you just couldn't hear them. And it's like, no, I could hear my one friend, Dan, like, my friend Dan laughing, and he was laughing. Like, you could tell he was just laughing in this way that was trying to start something. It was deadly silent. And I just remember getting off stage, and like I went home and started looking up on like the RMIT's website of how to do teaching, because I was like, this is it, I'm done. And yeah, and then from there I was like, you know, I looked at why, like, it was completely clear to me in retrospect how come the audience reacted in that way. I made a series of errors. And so I guess with, like, I don't know, like print reviews, sometimes like you read stuff and go, what are they fucking on about? And, but then other times, you know, there's stuff, like I remember getting a review from Helen Razor on the first play that I wrote. And like, it wasn't a great play, but she said that with a few more flying hours, she's going to be all right, essentially. And that kind of stuck with me. And I'm like, she's right. Like, I just needed to keep doing it. And, you know, and by failing and then analysing why you failed, why you didn't get that reaction that you wanted, or how did you get that reaction you did want, how did that work? You know, it's looking at the, you know, the alterations and the little tweaks and the little building steps to getting, you know, a laugh. Like, how did that happen? And, you know, until you get better at figuring out how to do it. So yeah, it's sort of, I don't, and I've always,
that's a gift of a negative review though, isn't it? Because it's on the one hand both, like, it's not awfully critical, but it's critical but encouraging.
So yeah, it's
actually very nice.
You just need to keep doing it. That's the same with a lot of people. Yeah, and like I've always really, like, we get notes all the time. You know, that's just, you know, when you people give you money, then they have, you know, usually they have a right to give you feedback on your work. And so that's, you know, kind of how it works in TV, books, whatever. And so, you know, there's always that trepidation when you're about to get a round of notes and anxiety around that. And I used to really prep myself for a fight. Like, I'm like, what the fuck are they going to say? How dare they? Every fucking word's perfect. Whereas now, like, I really value getting notes and, quite, you know, like 95% of the time it's like, I'll pay that. That's, you know, that seems fair enough to me. Or like they'll pick up on something that, you know, like you've cut accidentally that is the setup to this joke that pays off in the third act. And it's like, did you cut that? Oh, yeah, we did. We did cut that line. Or, you know, so there's little things that you just need an outsider's perspective on. It's like figuring out whose feedback you trust, I suppose. And, you know, and sometimes there'll be people who scare the hell out of you, that, you know, sometimes it's better to go to them than someone who is just going to blow smoke up your ass, you know. So it's finding out, you know, obviously you don't want to be collaborating with someone who destroys you and makes you feel like you don't have any talent. Like, that's really, you know, that's too far the other way. But you do want people to challenge you, you know, as long as you've all got the end game in mind of making the best, you know, piece of writing you can make.
On a recent episode of your Only Wrong Answers podcast, you and Kate act as kind of agony aunts. Someone wrote in and said that they often saw you and Kate McCartney around Darabin, and they asked the best way to approach you, and your response was basically don't.
clarify, that was we're in a pandemic, stay away.
I feel like it's a fine thing to say regardless, but starting with the positive, what is actually the nicest thing that a fan has ever done to you or your world?
We had a couple of fans who wrote to us, or one of them. No, actually it was a friend of theirs. So these two guys who got married, this was before same-sex marriage was legal in Australia, and these two guys who were fans of our show, their friend emailed us and said, is there any way that they could be in your show? And so the second season of Catering Show, we had this sort of big group scene at the start of like the opening kind of the show, and they came and they were in that opening, and then we just used them all the, like, we got them back, but they can't do this other thing for us, and they're like, yeah, sure. And so these two lovely guys just sort of like would keep coming and doing these little spots for us, like these really like tiny little things, but like it was so sweet, and we were like, this is, they're just, you know, they were just happy to kind of come in and do whatever little bits and pieces because they're like, we're fans. And, you know, so there's some Catering Show kind of like people who got on board really early on that, I don't know, they're like gold to us, you know, we love them. And so there's sort of just, I don't know, it's just general, like anyone who, any fan of ours who like replies to our stuff online or, like, but uses our humour that's within the show, like quotes us back or like repurposes our stuff. Like that's all very, we love it. Recently we did we tried to do this like piece to camera that sort of deciphered the government recommendations around what to do in like stage two or whatever. We just did it on a little video on Twitter. And then people, because we talked about Baker's Delight and Brumby's Bakery, and it just is like, I don't even know why. And these kids who were working there then started making TikToks that were like quoting that passage on TikTok. And that was just like, TikTok? Oh, what's TikTok? You know, so the idea that someone under the age of 25 even knows who we are, that's pretty cool. It's very validating. But, yeah, that's pretty fun. The weirdest thing that anyone's ever done was I was at a doctor's once with my kid when she was quite young. She had an ear infection, and just someone came up to me and was like, can I hold your baby? And just like,
oh God,
baby up and took her and was walking around the waiting room of this doctor's surgery. And I'm like, I'm like, so probably don't go up to someone and ask them if you can hold their baby.
That is great advice.
And your mother in a doctor's surgery, it's like, she's sick. What, you might catch what she...
It sounds like you gave the baby.
just so accommodating. I'm just like, I can't. Like, I find it really hard to say no to people. So, you know.
Final question. Do you have any sort of actual advice for other writers?
I mean, it's that classic thing. It's like, find that thing that you can say that no one else can say. And, you know, once you can kind of nut, you know, that's that journey to finding your voice, I suppose. And so I guess the best way to do that is just to keep writing, keep talking, you know. I think something that we've kind of figured out, I guess, is that, you know, like there are, like, you know, the silly saying that we've got is, you know, there's only wrong answers. So, you know, just throw it out there and then start the process of refining it from there. But I think you've got to do the work. That's the thing. Like, I think, you know, the mistakes that I made in my 20s with stuff that I did, like that stand-up gig, you know, it's like I didn't do the work. You know, it's like do the prep, be as prepped and as ready as you can be. You know, sometimes you just have to put the hours in. So, yeah, that's kind of
That's great.
That's brilliant. Yeah.
And that's it.
You can find the show notes for this episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. If you're feeling so inclined, we would love for you to leave us a review wherever you listen. This helps other people find us.
Get in touch with us via the contact page on our website or connect with the entire First Time gang on Twitter or Instagram at The First Time Pod. And don't forget, you can support us via Patreon. Go to patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We recorded this episode at Kathleen Syme Library on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. The First Time Podcast is produced by Phoebe 80 and supported by Writers Victoria, the ACT Writers Centre, and our wonderful patrons.